I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's making headlines all over. The president's son met with Russians who claim to have damaging information on Hillary Clinton. Looking for dirt on a campaign opponent is an age-old practice, but this latest revelation has people asking, where do you draw the line? Today, we'll speak with political consultants about what's fair and what isn't when it comes to opposition research. After that, as voters consider plans to stretch Kansas City's streetcar route, we'll ask the chief of the streetcar authority about future funding sources, proposals to expand service from the Plaza to the Mighty Mo, and a competing tax plan from a perennial light rail advocate. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When the president's older son met with a Russian lawyer, he was after information. That's pretty standard fare for campaigns, whether it be for president or Senate or Congress or even a local race for city council. It's called opposition research, and one way to describe it is digging up dirt on your opponent. A gentler way to say it is gathering public information to tell a story about your foe. That process has already begun in the 2018 race for the U.S. Senate in Missouri that pits Democrat Claire McCaskill against perhaps Republican Josh Hawley, the state's newly minted attorney general. Democrats already are tossing out information in an effort to discourage Hawley from entering that race. Here to talk about what's fair game in opposition research and what's not is John Hancock. He's the former chairman of the Missouri Republican Party, who's a partner in the full-service political consulting firm Hancock & Prouty. He joins us from the studios of KMOX in St. Louis. John, good morning.
Good to be with you, Stephen. I hope all is well over there.
Michael Kelly is a Democratic consultant and opposition researcher. He has served as political director of the Missouri AFL-CIO and executive director of the Missouri Democratic Party. He's founder of the Kelly Group, a public communications company. He and John Hancock co-host a program on KMOX in St. Louis, which they just completed just a few minutes ago. Michael, nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to catch up with you again, Steve.
What's your definition, John, of opposition research? What are we talking about here?
Well, you're looking at basically it's the public record of the target. And sometimes the target is your opponent and sometimes the target is your own client. And what you're trying to do is assemble all of the public record that's out there. If you're doing it for your own client, you're going to want to kind of take their public record and twist it and distort it the way their enemy is likely to do so that they're prepared for what may come in the heat of battle. If you're looking at your opposition candidate, you're going to want to look at the narrative of their career. Just looking at public records and their rhetoric, what they've said and their actions, what they've done, their voting record, to construct a narrative. And then you take those two pieces and you develop the messaging for the campaign that's going to be a contrast between those two rival candidates.
Michael, what would you add to that when it comes to defining what opposition research is?
Well, I think John's exactly right on, and it is only public information. You know, we don't spend time going through people's trash or finding stuff. It's public information and documents that you want to be able to compile on yourself and your opponent, and it's really the basis of what we do from campaigns. Steve, we often get folks who do this for a living will often hear from people who have information that they want to pass off to us, and you have to filter through that and realize that sometimes people have an agenda that they're pushing, but it is purely public information that is pulled together so that you can do this and find a contrast so that you can move forward with a narrative, not only for the campaign, but for polling and so many aspects of what will help your candidate ultimately win an election.
John, how do you defend it? I mean, a lot of people are put off by even the idea of opposition research.
Sure. Well, I view what we do as establishing truth. And one of the predominant themes that you find when you do a package on a candidate is hypocrisy. Says one thing, does another. And if there's anything that defines opposition research, that's probably it. And so there you're going to look at things like what that elected official has said about taxes, what they've said about foreign policy. And then you look at their voting record, whether in the current job they have or in previous elective offices they've had. And the campaign many times is able to point out that this candidate says he wants to help the taxpayer, says he wants to reduce the tax burden, but he's voted 27 times to raise your taxes. And here's the citations for all of those 27 votes. And if you approach it as establishing truth, you're not taking somebody's record and trying to twist it and contort it. Now, there are some in the profession that do that. I don't think that's the appropriate use of opposition research. Usually the record is adequate to point out that somebody is not what they claim to be.
Michael, when you show up at a cocktail party, do you tell people there that you do opposition research for Democrats?
Not necessarily. Most people realize that when you run campaigns that it's an essential tool. It does get a bad rap from people. But at the same time, those are the people who would also have eyebrows raised if a candidate isn't prepared for something that's going to be said about them. You know, the most important things in campaigns is certainty. You really want to understand what your message is and be able to deliver it, as well as understand what your opponent's up to.
And you need to be prepared, too. There's a great example that I often cite, and it's Mitt Romney and his income taxes in the 2012 campaign. Mm-hmm. You'll remember that, Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
And the Romney campaign should have known, may have known, that Mitt Romney's income taxes were going to be an issue as the thing came out. And you'll recall that when the Democrats started calling for the release of his income taxes, they kind of dribbled out, here's a year, here's 3 years, and then, whoops, that's all I'm going to give. And it didn't seem to me, I was not on the inside of that campaign, but it didn't seem to me that they had really worked through that entire episode, knowing full well that it was going to come. And what you've got to do in a situation like that is your research team has got to go through. If you're going to release your taxes, the research team needs to go through those taxes, find out all of the holes that are in there, identify where the enemy is going to attack, be ready to have a cogent, quick, concise response and description and explanation, and then you proceed in that way. If you're not prepared ahead of time, the opponent's opposition research can very well trip you up.
Michael, how big a business is this across the country?
Well, I can't think of a campaign that happens from state rep up to state senate through the federal government where candidates don't go and do research. In fact, it would be malfeasance not to do it. You need to know about yourself and your opponent. So almost any elective office of substance, you are going to have done opposition research on your opponent, and if you were a smart candidate, on yourself.
Yeah, we've done it for everything from city council races, you know, in Evansville, Indiana,
mm-hmm.
All the way to U.S. Senate races and governor's races, primary and general election. And, you know, doing oppo in a primary is different than doing oppo in a general election, because in a primary, you're going to want, if you're a Republican, you're going to want to disqualify the opponent as being the true conservative in the race.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, on the Democrat side, you're going to want to disqualify that person as being a true liberal. The package reads differently if it's a primary package versus a general election package that's designed to communicate to the full electorate.
Michael, are there areas you won't go? I'm wondering about personal medical history, for instance, family, private family matters. What's considered to be off limits?
You can't get that information, nor do you want it. All the information that we're getting when we do a record search is public information that anyone can get. Getting a hold of someone's medical history or something would be against the law, and that's not something you can access through public document searches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing I would add, though, and of course in Missouri now it's changed, but it used to be that you could access a divorce file, and those were public court records, and you can get the divorce settlement file and the court proceedings and all of the rulings and so forth. And those things have proven at times. Sometimes they talk about extramarital affairs. Really, it's not something that I don't think I've ever used that in a campaign. But there have been instances where there's been a divorce file, and as part of that file, with child custody and child payments and so forth, that one of the spouses or both of the spouses or jointly, they will release, they put their income taxes in there. And I have had a case where a candidate was running for office, and in their divorce file, it was demonstrated that they paid no, though they were quite wealthy, they paid no federal income taxes. Well, now all of a sudden, that's a public record, and that's a relevant, I would contend, that's a relevant item to discuss during the course of a campaign.
Who determines what's fair game and what's not?
Well, it really, it's up to the campaign itself. You know, we certainly give direction and advice to our clients. And, you know, a lot of there's sometimes, too, Steve, where something will be true in the opposition research. You'll find something that maybe is shocking or whatever, but it's so outrageous that it's not credible. Even though it's true, I would advise not to use it because it's just not credible as a messaging point. And so that's sort of the art of the trade is deciding how to take the information and how to dispense it, how to put it in context, because you're usually sharing it in 30-second increments on ads or in a direct mail piece that's limited in the terms of how many words you can put on there. And so those are matters of art that not just the opposition researcher, but the campaign strategist and ultimately the candidate themselves decide what they're going to use and how they're going to disseminate it.
And that's where it ultimately rests, is on the candidate, because sometimes people will perceive something to be out of bounds, and that's a decision that the candidate ultimately is going to have to make, because they're going to have to live with the consequences of whatever they choose to move forward
with. And there's some candidates that just refuse to use anything negative about their opponent, and that's certainly their prerogative to do so. I've worked on campaigns where we've been retained to do a research package, and we put together the package, and I think there's three or four really solid contrasts in there. But at the end of the day, the candidate running for office says, nah, I'm not going to go there. And so you don't.
We're talking about opposition research and political campaigns with Democrat Michael Kelly, Republican John Hancock. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Michael, so if someone with personal knowledge of a candidate approaches you, what do you do? How do you handle it?
Well, it just depends. People do come forward with information all
sure
the time,
they do.
Steve.
All the time. Yeah.
And, you know, when you're in a business like this, more often than not, you have to view it through the prism of what that person's bringing the information with. If it's something that's gathered illegal, then you have to deal with that immediately and step away from it and turn it over to the proper authorities. But more often than not, it's people who have an agenda. You need to understand that. You can take the information. It's all usually information that you would be able to get.
You've already gotten.
Or already have gotten. But it's always helpful to see it through their prism and understand exactly what their motivation is.
Yeah, I would say, Steve, I've been doing this for a long time. And, you know, Oppo has evolved. It used to be, you know, 20 years ago, your Oppo operation was maybe some law school students who would put together whatever they could, and you'd get a box of stuff. I mean, literally a box of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be your Oppo file. Now it's a highly professionalized. Michael's got a PhD.
Yeah, I've got a PhD in political science who does nothing but research like this. More often than not, on the candidates that we're working for rather than the ones we're working against.
And so,
again, just so you know what's coming, right, Michael?
Exactly.
Yeah, but in the case that you cited, Steve, we say you get called. You know, it's somebody on the phone. Hey, I want to meet with a candidate. I got the goods on your opponent. You won't believe this stuff. I mean, it's unbelievable, this stuff I've got. Though that happens, I probably had 36 times that's happened in various races that I've been involved with. And there's a couple of rules that we use. Number one, never send the candidate in to or one of the principals with a campaign for that meeting. You just don't do that. You find somebody that's far enough removed from the campaign. Because of fact number two, I would say that 90% of the time over the course of years, what they have, if it's anything, it's either unusable hearsay rumors, which is not Oppo,
right?
Or it's material that you've long since gone through it, that's a public record that you, if you're any good at what you do, you've already found it. And almost without fail, those people that want to come to you with their dirt, they're in there because they want a job. They want the campaign to pay off something. They've got a side issue that they want to get in with. They want to develop a relationship with a candidate and so forth. And we just never put our clients in a position to sit through those, because almost without fail, they don't pay off.
And I can't think of a substantive time where I got information from a third party that my folks hadn't automatically collected on their own. Have you, John?
That's interesting.
No. And rumor is not Oppo. Rumor is rumor. And you can't, I mean, we won't use a rumor in a campaign.
Let's go to some phone calls. Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on with John Hancock and Michael Kelly. Good morning.
Good morning, John, Michael. This is a national issue. How can anybody try to get Donald Trump's income tax returns, and why not? It's very complicated. I'll take the answer off here. Thanks a lot.
Why haven't we gotten Trump's tax returns?
Well, he won't release them. And income tax records are not public records. And so it's up to the candidate themselves. We talk when we have clients that are, you know, successful or wealthy, we always discuss with them on the front end of the campaign. You need to decide up front whether or not you're going to release your income tax records if they're called for. And you should assume that they'll be called for. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to release them, then we need to see them. And if you're not going to release them, then you need to be able to explain why you're not releasing them. In Trump's case, he said he's under audit, but he's got there's no legal compunction for him to release them, and there's no way to pierce. Now, Bob Mueller is going to see those income taxes because he's a special prosecutor. He's got subpoena access to them. Folks that do political operatives like Michael and I, we have no ability to look at that stuff.
So once Mueller subpoenas those records, will they become public? I'm talking about his tax returns.
No. That's just not a public record.
Yeah, unless he finds something illegal that he moves forward with. Other than that, we will never see him.
Right. The only time I've ever seen tax returns made public is through divorce cases.
My experience has been, more often than not, it was a political risk for the president not to come forward with the tax information. More often than not, we're recommending to our clients that you do come forward with it, that full transparency. And as a Democrat watching from the outside, thought this was a huge gamble for Donald Trump, and it was, but it paid off for him not to release it.
So given all this, gentlemen, what do you make of the president's son, who was seeking opposition research on Hillary Clinton last year, and the way he went about it?
Well, the way that he went about it and the information that we have is to this meeting, this may be the closest thing that we can find to a collusion link at this point. To have those folks in that room, I mean, you would have never, John, if you were advising, had the campaign chairman, the campaign's son-in-law, and all the strategy people sitting there with what was known to be foreign nationals, which would be illegal.
I think folks are reading a lot more into this than what is there. What happened here is, Donald Trump has never been in a campaign before, Junior. He gets an email from a buddy saying, hey, I got this guy. They've got all kinds of dirt on Hillary Clinton. You ought to meet with him. Well, the natural inclination of somebody that's not been through this before is, oh, let's see what they got. Maybe there's something in there we can, you know, that would be a natural inclination. Now, when you're jaded and have been doing this as long as I have, you know, you take that information. Okay, great. Well, we're going to tell them they can go meet with Joe over here and meet at a public coffee shop and see what they got. And you know, and it's going to be nothing, by the way. I mean, that, you know, I really kind of chalk this up to just a rookie mistake on the part of Junior.
Some really smart people who'd been through a lot of campaigns who made a rookie mistake then.
Well, Paul Manafort, yeah. He hadn't been through any campaigns recently.
John, we are talking about a meeting with a hostile foreign government.
Yeah, yeah. No,
there's let that fact not go unnoticed here.
Right. Yeah, well, no question about it. And I mean, that for me, that would be a red flag flying very high in the sky.
But if you would have done it, John, you're saying you would have sent campaign underlings, low-level people, not bringing in the top-level folks like this.
You'd never send top-level. If the email content that came into the campaign is, this is the Russian government and they're trying to help you, no, you don't take that meeting.
Yeah.
But if it's, hey, this guy worked with the Clinton Foundation, this would be a more reasonable or more realistic. Here's this guy who worked for the Clinton Foundation. He says there's all kinds of corrupt pay-to-play going on, and he's got the goods on it. You know, that would be the kind of thing that would be enticing on a phone call. And even there, I would never send the campaign or a principal into that meeting.
We would be more likely to get a former law enforcement official who now works on the side to go and gather that information because they would understand the law. And if someone was violating, they could just go straight to the authorities.
Let's go to Justin from Kansas City, Missouri. Justin, you're on Up to Date with two stars from the KMOX constellation here.
Morning,
Justin,
John,
good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, John and Michael. I have a question about the procedure here, about how you collect your OBO. Do you use any kind of big data or data science, or do you actually have people going through old news records and just trying to go back as far as they can and find anything they can get?
Most of the press accounts, the public record is, you know, it's going to be online, whether it was originally published in a newspaper or a blog or social media. And we do go through all of that, and we've got some algorithms that run that. But we also do a lot of old school stuff. My firm, actually, I use retired FBI agents all over the country. So if I've got a campaign in Chattanooga, Tennessee, there'll be a retired agent that lives within 30 miles of that courthouse. And so we'll contact them through my contact, and we'll get a retired FBI agent to go to that courthouse and get all the public records available, police reports, tax record, you know, in property tax and real property tax payments that are available, any court filings where they've been a plaintiff or a defendant in a civil or criminal matter. We'll get all of those public records, and that's who we use to do the groundwork.
And more, all of this information is accessible online. I mean, it's the same thing that most lawyers and law firms use to be able to research stuff. But there are documents that come from several decades ago. The only way you're going to get it is if you show up in a courthouse or a county office building.
Yep.
Justin, thank you. Yeah, appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You know, what about Democrats releasing information on Josh Hawley, who's said to be interested in running for the U.S. Senate next year against Claire McCaskill, but he's not even in the race yet, and Democrats are leaking information about Hawley to the media. One area of interest is Hawley's ties to a big GOP donor, a man named David Humphreys of Joplin. Is this fair game even at this early point in the race?
Well, if you're an elected official in the state of Missouri, any public information is going to be fair game. And
but he's not even a candidate yet, Michael.
Well, he's rumored to be a candidate. He's a man who's had some of the biggest institutional Republicans and Jack Danforth and Sam Fox pushing him to do it. He's a public official, and people need to understand his record and the inconsistencies in the things he says.
And sometimes information is used when a candidate's been rumored to get into a race. You know, you don't want, if I'm running a client who's running for something, I'm not interested in somebody getting into his her primary. And so when a candidate's rumored to be getting in, if you've got some oppo on that person, then sometimes a skillful release of the oppo might convince that person, maybe I don't want to get in this race. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
But doesn't
it's
all
the,
this
the end, record?
But doesn't all this, John, end up discouraging people from running for public office who might otherwise be great public officials? I mean, people hear this kind of stuff and they think, I don't want to touch this game with a 40-foot pole.
Well, I mean, campaigns are, it's a tough business. I mean, there's no two ways about it.
Is it too
Stephen,
tough, but, though? I mean, that's not what it's, is it supposed to be that way?
Well, a public record, a record, is what we run on when we run for office and the candidate runs. And I've been a candidate. So you run on that record and you defend that record. But you, at the end of the day, the publication of that record and the discussion of that record is entirely appropriate. I would even contend it's in a free and open democratic system as we have. It's imperative that the public have access to this information.
And this isn't a new process. This has been going on since the history of our country. I went and saw Alexander Hamilton, the musical, this weekend, and they were digging up dirt on extramarital affairs even back then and putting it out. It's just a part of the process that we have.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation right there on opposition research. I want to thank John Hancock, a former chair of the Missouri Republican Party, Michael Kelly, a Democratic consultant, opposition researcher, both stars at KMOX. Guys, thanks a lot for taking some time. I sure appreciate
it. Always a pleasure, Stephen. Always a pleasure.
Love talking to you, Steve.
You bet, guys. All the best to you. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk streetcars and streetcar expansion. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, we met the 11-year-old girl who's normalizing limb difference and creating a glitter shooting prosthetic. And we learned about the fine art of noodling for catfish. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll visit with a Park University student who won silver at this year's prestigious Van Cliburn piano competition. And with August voting quickly approaching, we'll ask local officials just how safe are our voting systems. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, expansion of Kansas City's streetcar system is a hot topic these days as voters consider plans to grow the system beyond its current River Market to Union Station route. So far, many Kansas Cityans agree that the streetcar has been a success with ridership exceeding expectations. But some questions remain. Will the federal government pitch in its share to expand the system? And what about Clay Chastain's proposal, which is on the August ballot? With us is Tom Garand. He's executive director of KC Streetcar. And Tom, good to have you here. Welcome.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, this idea that we need streetcars and we aren't crazy about buses is something that most people get. But that feeling, you know, that sentiment, Tom, is costing the city a whole lot of money. Does it make sense?
Well, I think, first of all, it's not an either-or proposition. Streetcars and buses work hand-in-hand as part of a regional vision. And what we've been attempting to do is to continue to elevate that conversation and leverage the streetcar that we have, obviously, to its fullest, get the most out of that investment, and then think about how do we logically grow that system where it makes sense to do so and where we can bring resources.
Argument here is we're spending tens of millions of dollars on a streetcar system, which has limited capacity in terms of where it goes, as opposed to investing more heavily in buses, which are much more flexible and go everywhere. And what are we doing here? At least that's what critics say.
Well, it's a long-term investment. So does it cost more from a capital perspective to put a streetcar route on Main Street as opposed to a bus circulator? Of course it does. But it's a 50-year investment. And when you look at the opportunity cost and when you look at the life cycle cost of what that does to bring additional investment downtown, to attract economic development, to provide a higher level of service with cars that can carry more people, fully electrified fleet, all of those things together tell you that from a financial perspective, that streetcar is a good play. I will tell you that the cost per trip is cheaper for streetcar than any other service in the region.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Why is there this connection between development of a streetcar line and economic development? This notion that businesses are springing up on, you know, both sides of the streetcar line. Why? I mean, what's the draw there?
Well, first of all, you have to look back to our history, that this isn't a new dynamic. We were built around a streetcar system of 300 plus miles. Many of the buildings in our historic core were structured and built there because of the access to public transportation at the time. And it really is about the permanence. It's about the permanence. It's about the fixed rail investments. Developers know that when we build a public investment like a streetcar and you lay those rails in the ground, that investment is long term and that we are committing to that corridor for the next 40 and 50 years.
And traffic's going to be generated as a result.
Traffic will be generated. And then from an economic development and investment perspective, that's a safe place to go because, you know, we're not walking away from that location. We're not going to move it to another street and it will be here for the foreseeable future.
If you have questions about streetcars, the expansion proposals on the ballot coming up, you're welcome to give us a call. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, I think everybody, Tom, can agree that the streetcar exceeded expectations. What's your theory as to why that happened?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think a big part of that is the timing. I think we came and we brought streetcar downtown at the right time, building on the Power and Light investment, the Kauffman Center, the renovated historic Union Station.
Everything's interconnected here.
And the opportunity for us to connect those assets that we've already spent as a community a lot of money in was a great opportunity. And so connecting them, timing was one part, but I think the other part was how we did it. We built a system that was easy to use, was intuitive. It's not 50 miles an hour, but it's very efficient and direct. And obviously our decision to make that service free without a fare, to remove the barrier and to encourage use and promote activity and economics, really activity throughout the district, has proven very successful.
I was going to ask you about that decision to make it free. Was that a hard call? And is it going to remain free forever?
Well, it was an interesting discussion. It was really a business decision. Our board, who represents downtown interests, said, what does it cost to collect a fare, to administer a fare? What's it going to do to press ridership? And when we took all of those things into consideration, we realized, you know, a fare system was going to cost us millions of dollars to implement. It was going to depress ridership by 30 to 50%. 75% of our collections were going to be reinvested to just maintain it and to enforce it, and that we could remove all of that. And we could double ridership, and we could double sales activity, and we in the downtown and really use it as an economic stimulus, which is what we were really intending to do. And we've seen that play out. We have a 65% growth in sales tax collections within the downtown TDD district compared to 16% citywide. And it is moving people. Those people are buying things. We're collecting that on the back end through a sales tax in the district. And that model is fully sustainable. And so we don't need to charge a fare to pay for the operations and maintenance of the system. The growth in sales taxes, the forecasts are really strong, and we're where we need to be. And so we'll have a conversation as it relates to expansion and how that fare policy may play out as we expand. But for the time being, there's no schedule to institute a fare on the downtown route. And as long as it's a 2-mile modern streetcar in the heart of downtown, I feel confident saying that's going to remain free.
Then how about the extension? Presumably, if it's approved out to UMKC, it'll be free too?
Well, that's a policy conversation that we'll be having, and we'll be doing some of the same analysis that we did on the first project to look at the costs and benefits. Clearly, the riding public and the businesses love the no fare policy. Removing the barriers, make it very easy to use, is attractive for a lot of reasons. And so one of the conversations we're having is, obviously, can we extend the system and make it free? Folks would love if we have the ability to do that. And part of that's going to be dependent on the financial strategy. And we're seeing other conversations in the region about how do we remove the fare barrier so we can provide transportation for free for even a broader set of stakeholders regionwide.
At what point will you make that decision about whether it's free or not for the extended route?
Well, it's probably over the course of the next 12 to 18 months as we're going through the detailed project design, as we're developing the really detailed financial planning. That's going to be a policy decision that would be made at that time.
You know, given what you're saying here, Tom, I can't help but wonder, has the city and maybe many cities made a mistake by not making bus routes free, bus transit free?
There are a handful of systems around the country that have done that, but not many. And I can tell you our partners at Ride KC and Robbie Mackinnon, the CEO over there, is very interested in trying to find a way to remove the fare barrier. They've been able to do it for the veterans program that they've launched, which has been incredibly successful. Mm-hmm. And so clearly the benefit of providing public transportation, like we do highways and roadways, for people to be able to utilize without a cost, direct cost, and to encourage use of that system is something that's been really attractive to us.
So basically revenue for building the streetcar just comes from the tax increase that's levied in the surrounding areas.
That's right. There's a special district that's formed, and there's a sales and a property tax from within that district that is collected to help, one, pay for the capital costs for construction, and then, two, to pay for the ongoing operations and maintenance expenses.
816-235-2888 is our phone number here if you have questions about streetcars and the expansion here. You're talking about expanding the system, again, from Union Station out to UMKC. How much would that cost, do you think?
It's a $225 million to $250 million extension.
You know, you've called the ballot process unique for how this is happening. Critics say it was set up to ensure passage of streetcar extensions. Is the whole thing jerry-rigged a little bit?
That's completely not true. The process, the RTA who sponsored the petition drive is following the state requirements that mandate the process and the steps that must be taken. So I think if you were to ask them directly, they would tell you they wish there was an easier way to do this. This is the way that the state legislation, the state laws dictate the process be conducted. And so they're following those processes. I would say also.
But the notion that if you went citywide, Tom, that again, what critics say is it would fail because so many folks in the outer reaches of town who wouldn't directly benefit wouldn't vote for it. The result would be defeat.
Well, it's hard to say. It depends on the plan. We've had plans, you know, a prior Clay Chastain plan passed citywide. Oh, the recent Eastside sales tax passed citywide. And so we've seen citywide propositions pass. And I think a lot has changed with regards to the perception of streetcar over the course of the last year. What I would say, though, is many view this as a more equitable strategy because the people close to the line are the folks who are paying for it. And you're not asking people who are 20 and 50 miles away to help offset the cost yeah. of the construction of a project that they won't receive direct benefit from.
Walk us through this process, Tom, because there are three phases here, and I know a deadline is coming up soon. Explain what the three phases are, because it is a little confusing.
Yes, there's three phases, as you mentioned. The first is the formation election, where residents of the district request a ballot. They submit a ballot. The deadline is August 1st for those submissions to
That's
be
the
in.
To form the district.
To form the district.
Mm-hmm.
And based on the parameters that have been approved by the circuit court. The second is the director's election. So there will be an elected board of directors that will sit on this TDD board if it is formed. And that is going to be an in-person election on October 10th. And then the third is the funding election, which would actually levy the sales and property taxes. So the first district's to form, the third is to actually make a determination about the levying of the actual tax mechanisms, the sales tax and the property tax assessments. And that is in early 2018, that will take place.
Okay. Federal funding is said to be a required component here. Are we guaranteed federal money if voters approve these three things?
Absolutely not. And it's a concern we have, to be honest, that it's possible we could form a district and we could be sort of waiting on the federal government for a match that will be fundamentally required to make this financing work and to make this project whole. The state of the federal administration and the conversations around a national transportation program, frankly, give us some concern about the state of the future public transportation program. But we need to do our own work. Oftentimes, regardless of administration, the federal position is get your own house in order, bring your local money, your local share, and then come and make your request.
Would you start collecting the taxes if there's no federal match?
No. And so the language of the proposal specifically dictates that district won't be activated and turned on until we have a complete financing plan that can really realize the full project.
Tom Garrett is my guest. He's executive director of KC Streetcar. Again, our phone number, 816-235-2888. Stacy from Olathe. Stacy, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi. I had a question. I lived for a time in St. Louis where they have the Metrolink light rail system, and I know you were talking about potentially expanding down to UMKC or taking it further maybe out to the airport. Would that be something that would be better done streetcar, or is it how different is that from light rail, like something they have in St. Louis?
Yeah, good question, Stacy. Yeah.
Great question. And it really is, there's a lot of similarities. The primary difference is, do the transit vehicles run in their own guideway, their own dedicated lane, or are they running in mixed traffic like the current streetcar system is downtown? And as we extend, we suspect there may be segments of routes and extensions that could look more like light rail, where stop spacing is farther apart, speeds might be higher, you might have some sections of dedicated lane. Surely for the corridors that we've looked at, we'll have in-street service that's very similar to the current streetcar, but these vehicles were designed and procured to give us the capacity to run faster and to run at longer distances. So the system really can take on characteristics of light rail. It's called light rail in other places with these same cars and the same technology. It really is, how do we deploy them? What does the route look like? What are the goals of the system? Are they to move people? Is it, how many stops do we have? Those will be the factors that will really dictate the performance.
If you were to go to KCI, would you go to a light rail kind of approach given the distance?
Well, I suspect you would. You would probably use a different higher speed, longer distance technology than what we're currently looking at with streetcar extensions.
Duran suggests by Twitter an 8-cent citywide sales tax could replace the Ride KC transit fare revenue. That makes sense?
That could be close. I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I would defer to my friends at Ride KC for that. But they're looking closely at what would it take to make the bus system free also. How would that work? What are the implications of that? And so that's possible.
We also got a tweet asking, are there plans to add bike parking to station stops?
It's a great suggestion. We're just now kicking off the detailed planning and design work. So what we really have is a concept for an extension, and we have to do a lot of detailed due diligence on where does it run in the street, what do the station stops look like, how are they designed, What is the terminal station or the terminus station at the end of the line look like, and exactly how will that all function, and how many cars do we need? So the station stop design will be one of those questions that we'll be getting into in more detail over the course of the next 12 months.
Streetcars expansion is our topic here today. Tom Garand is our guest. 816-235-2888 is the number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Lynn Horsley at the Star had an interesting story last week about this ongoing controversy, Tom, here over who gets to vote in these three elections you pointed out and who gets left out. Some business owners say it's not fair that the lines have been gerrymandered in a sense. They point out point to the Walnuts apartment complex at 51st and Warnell was left out, and critics sort of wonder why that's the case. What do you say to that?
Well, I think ultimately it was a court-approved boundary that was deemed to be legal. And so there was a process that the RTA went through to propose a boundary. There was an opportunity for a review of that, an appeal of that, and ultimately the court found the boundary to be legal. I think, as I've said in the past, anytime you're talking about a new tax proposition for whatever the purpose, you're never going to find a perfect solution. You're talking about a new fee and a new expense that some folks won't like, regardless of how you draw it. And so
right. That's,
I think, a fact of the matter with this particular issue.
There's a question on the August ballot, too, that would make streetcar funding a citywide decision. What's your reaction to this, and does KC Streetcar have a position on this ballot question?
My board does not have a position on it. They've not considered it specifically. I'll give you my personal position. As you read that language, it's not just streetcar funding. It's restricting city staff from participating in streetcar planning and streetcar due diligence and other conversations around system expansion. And the planner in me says that would be really unfortunate, because cities around the country and regions around the country, you know, as one of their core functions, need to plan for their future. And so how does the city bring forward a proposal for funding if they can't do due diligence on what it would look like, what it would cost,
right. How
it would operate? And surely the city needs to be a part of any future conversations within the region about how we grow our system. So planning and due diligence is an important component of that. And the last thing I would say is any project, whether it's a district-based funding proposal, as we're advancing now, or an alternative extension, is going to require public investment. And the reality is there isn't a big bucket of money that's just sitting out there. There's going to have to be a public vote, whether it be a district-based or a citywide vote or a countywide vote or even a regional vote, mm-hmm. which I would love to see someday. So there will be an opportunity for the public to chime in on any expansion that we would advance ultimately, because they're going to require local investments to make those things happen.
Let's go to Christopher from Kansas City, Missouri. Christopher, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I was just curious about what the cost of this new streetcar expansion could do if it were instead put into simply making the existing bus routes more robust.
Hmm. Thank you, Christopher.
Well, it really depends on what you do, right? I mean, it depends on how would you utilize those resources. And what are the other things that you would build? As I mentioned, we focus a lot on the upfront operational cost or the expense of the construction of the streetcar. But what we don't talk about is that the vehicles that we're buying have a 30-year useful life instead of a 10 or 12-year useful life for a typical bus investment, right? That they're three times the size, that we have 50-year investments in other infrastructure. And so as you play all of those things out, it really is, what is the system that we need to be building for the city for the next 50 years? And how do we make incremental investments, which we've been attempting to do, to get us there, right? We're competing with St. Louis and Denver's and Minneapolis. And this isn't about reinvesting in things that we built 20 years ago and 15 years ago. It's about how do we grow our system? How do we raise the bar? How do we give our public a really quality public transportation system that they can be proud of and that, frankly, can be a catalyst for how we grow ourselves as a city and as a region in the years to come?
Now, Tom, how does Clay Chastain's plan jibe with the streetcar extension? He wants a 3/8-cent sales tax for 25 years. It would include light rail, streetcars, electric buses. What do you make of it?
Well, I think, as I've said in the
You're
past...
You're smiling, I should point
I'm
out.
I'm smiling because we've had this conversation for years and decades, frankly, and throughout my career. And I applaud Clay for his vision with regards to what a public transportation system can do to really help drive a community forward. And he believes in that, and I believe in that, frankly. So we share some common ground. Where we've differed in the past is, right, his plan for execution has always been challenged by the realities of costs and system details.
He would have taken money from the existing bus system in at least one case, right?
In most of his prior questions, this one is not structured that way. Most of his prior questions would have diverted resources from the bus system, and that, frankly, was a non-starter for the federal government and for all of the local stakeholders who rely heavily on the existing transit
system. But as you point out, he's not doing that now,
right.
So
he's proposing a 3/8-cent citywide sales tax to expand the streetcar and to bring electric buses there. There's lots of details and issues with the specifics of the proposal in terms of, you know, we would still have concerns if the city was obligated to build the whole project, that it could be afforded. We don't believe it could be afforded. But clearly, we're interested in additional investment in streetcar expansion. Cut it out.
If it passes, would it bring great disruption?
Well, it would be a question that the city would have to, and the council and their legal staff would have to determine, is it usable to grow the system? Clearly we would anticipate there would be a legal challenge and process that would relate to that. But ultimately, that decision would fall to the council and to the city administration to determine how does that relate to the plan that we feel like we can actually deliver to the voters within the city of Kansas City, Missouri. And at the end of the day, that's been the hang-up, right? It's been that the past plan that was rescinded from council in 2008 was in part largely rescinded because it couldn't be delivered and afforded. And so it was just a commitment the city was not in a position to make. And so that same evaluation would have to take place.
Just quickly, Tom, I got 30 seconds. Would it bring a pot of money that you could tap to fund other transit projects?
Well, as my read of the language, it's to extend the current streetcar system with some additional details, as well as to bring money to electric bus network. And so it does sound like there's some opportunities there for additional investments. But again, the devil's in the details as it relates to what could actually be delivered and would that add value to growing the system over time.
That's Tom Guerin. He's executive director of KC Streetcar. Thanks for the good conversation. Thanks for enlightening us here, Tom.
Happy to
Appreciate
be here.
Appreciate it. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, we ask local officials how secure our voting systems are, and we meet the Park University pianist attracting a lot of attention from the classical music world. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell produce our program. I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.